Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Yes, it is. It's Brett King, and I'm here with my good friend JP Nichols, who's co-hosting today. And yeah, we are the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. We make that claim because back in 2013, we were the first fintech radio show on the AM band anywhere in, on terrestrial radio anywhere in the world. We started out in AM band in New York, and of course now we're global in 170 countries. It just blows my mind. But I'm hosting today. JP Nichols is here with me. We have today's show is brought to you by our friends at the Digital Banking Report. Bank and credit union executives and solution providers worldwide use insights from the Digital Banking Report to keep pace with digital transformation in financial services. If you're a listener, you can save $1,500 on a 10-person subscription for a limited time by using the coupon code POWER10 if you go to digitalbankingreport.com. And also, today's show is brought to you by Cornerstone Advisors, their Insight Vault, looking for refreshing, practical insights on the top trends in banking and innovation, on the top trends in fintech. We'll get the Insight Vault at bit.ly/insightvault. I'm having trouble talking today, JP. I don't know what that is about. But
anyway. It's always fun reading URLs.
Yeah. Yeah. Bit.ly. Anyway. Okay. So today we're going to look at some.
I always thought it was bit.ly.
Bit, oh, yeah.
Now, in like Ron's case, it might be .ly.
But, Jet Li. Yeah. Okay. Today we're going to have a look at some of the challenges that banks and credit unions are facing in the world of rapidly changing digitization. Now, of course, we know that the big boys, you know, the Chases, the DBSs, the I'm trying to think of other good leaders.
Well, Deutsche Bank, they got it all figured out, right?
Oh, yeah,
everything
okay.
Good there?
If they don't go out of business. So these guys have got it all. They're putting hundreds of millions of dollars into technologies like mobile, artificial intelligence, so forth. But what about these smaller, companies that have a smaller balance sheet and don't have the sort of cash to spend on innovation? Are they going to survive? Is it business as usual? This is the conversation we want to have today. Jim Morales is going to join us shortly. He's publisher of Digital Banking Report and co-publisher of The Financial Brand. We've got Ron Shevlin here with us. Ron is the director of research for Cornerstone Advisors. Welcome back, Ron.
Thanks, Brett. Thanks for having me.
And coming up in the second half of the show is Julie Thurlow, the CEO of Reading Cooperative Bank, and she's going to lend her perspective. I understand Jim has joined us now, or he's about to. Here he is.
Yep, I am here. Glad to join you. Sorry I'm a little late.
You came hot off a webinar. So what was your webinar on, dude?
It was on financial education and Gen Z.
Gen Z. Okay,
I probably caught up to millennials, and we're already into Gen Z.
Yeah, the post-millennial generation, sometimes called Generation Alpha, actually. So the Gen Z is very, very interesting. Okay, now let's get to the conference announcements and news. So American Bankers Digital Banking Conference is on next week, June 6th through 8th in Austin, Texas, 650-plus. I got the update on this. It's more than 1,200 senior-level executives from financial institutions, credit unions, and solution providers from both the U.S. and around the globe. So this event, Digital Banking 2017, will be a three-day event. Jim will be there, I understand. Yeah, Jim?
Yep, I will be.
I will be there. Ron, you're going to be there too, right?
I will be there.
Fantastic. Are you going to do your Finovate spiel on the future of the bank account, Ron, or what are you talking on?
No, I'm actually not actually presenting at the conference. I was going to moderate a debate between Sam Maul and Dan Kimmerling, but Sam needed to move the session, so I had to bail out. But I am doing a roundtable discussion on the impact of Amazon. So anybody going to be at the conference, that'll be a hot topic. So come find us Wednesday afternoon.
Fantastic. All right. June 10th through 14th, I'll be in Australia for AMP's Amplify event and also be doing the closing keynote at RFI's Retail Banking Awards down there in Sydney, Australia. And then FinTech Week is July 16th through 13th in London. So if you're watching that, that's where the world of fintech comes to, which is debatably, it's certainly one of the world's fintech capitals, if not the fintech capital of the world, certainly as an employer, London has become the largest employer of fintech resources. But FinTech Weeks really looks at the dialogue between multinationals, innovation firms, disruptive startups, governments, media, and investors.
Yeah, and we have one more coming up also in Europe where we're a media partner with Block Show Europe Conference. Now, that's coming up May 28th, 29th. We just missed that one. We don't even have to talk about that one. Today's the 31st of May.
Oh,
we still had that. So I sure hope that was a good one. I had that still on our list for this week. And that one's done. So if you've got something you want to share with our audience, do hit us up on Twitter at BreakingBanks1 or just email us directly at info@provoke.fm.
Fantastic. All right. Well, now to the news. Now, first of all, GDPR. Does anyone know what GDPR stands for?
Well, we all do now because our inboxes are full of those four letters.
Absolutely. So this new data protection regulation coming out of the UK and the European Union more broadly is starting to really change the way we get this. Now, if you guys want to check this out, our privacy policy has changed. You can look at the Voice America site if you want to check out how we look at data privacy and also how we do it at Provoke. You can check out provoke.fm. But it's interesting to see that Calm, the meditation app, now has BBC announcer Peter Jefferson reading the GDPR regulation as a way to go to sleep.
Yeah. We could close a show with that, and people that go to sleep with the Breaking Banks podcast, that ought to be the perfect antidote.
Okay, so short-term impact, lots of emails, but long-term impact for marketers, yeah, it's interesting. There's a really good, there's a really good summary on the Mary Meeker report, which we're going to talk about a bit later, around this sort of conflict of privacy, which is we're getting more and more open, we're required to share more and more data, and in the midst of this is this privacy pushback. So I think we should probably talk about that a little bit later. But what about Square, JP? What's Square in the news for?
Well, yeah, Jack Dorsey thinks that Square could be a threat for primary banking accounts. He recently said people are using this as their primary banking account, and in some cases, it's their only bank account. We're reaching an audience that's underserved and even to the point of unbanked, which wasn't a stated goal, but it's something we love and we want to learn more about. Now, Ron, you wrote in your latest Cornerstone Insight Vault piece about this, and you said that Dorsey may be accurate in that people are using it as their primary banking account, but it's probably not a very large number. What are your thoughts here?
So I think Jack was a bit flippant in his comments. I don't think he's got a lot of data to back up his claims there. I surveyed consumers at the end of last year in the U.S., asked them who they banked with and who their primary bank was, and only 7% of millennials said that a digital-only bank was their primary bank. And what's interesting and might be surprising to a lot of people is that that percentage only varies by about 1% or 2% as even you get older. So it's not like young consumers are flocking to digital banks, nor is it true that the older consumers don't want the digital banks. But I think what Jack is missing too here in his statement is that I don't think they're reaching an underserved group at all. In fact, very few consumers are... especially using digital tools, are unbanked these days. So I think what he's really capturing is the thing I've been talking a lot about in a number of conferences recently around deposit displacement. And the idea is that the checking account has really become a paycheck motel, a temporary place for people's money to stay before it goes on to bigger and better places. So I think what Dorsey and Square are seeing is a lot of usage for its tool, but it's not replacing the checking account, nor has it really become the primary checking account.
You know, that's definitely the case in China, where you've seen people with the super wallets, with Alipay and with WeChat. They will transfer money out of their – they don't have checking accounts, of course. They have current accounts. They don't have checks in China. They've evolved beyond that. But so that was a U.S. joke. What happens is people transfer money into the super wallet and it doesn't go back into the debit account. So, you know, they're getting paid through this. So maybe that's a precursor of this type of, you know, cloud-based wallet services as we use these more and more, particularly for things like voice commerce and other things like that. I think you're going to see more and more where the lines will blur between a primary bank account and your primary value store that you use for conducting commerce. I don't know. We'll see how that evolves. In the US, it may evolve differently than how it has in China and other parts of Asia. We'll see.
You know, Brad, hey. I mentioned this, I think, a couple weeks ago, but on my business account, I am now, where we used to receive most of our payments for the digital banking report, either through wire or through checks, we are now receiving, and some through credit cards, we're now receiving about 80% of our payments through credit card via PayPal. And what I realize now is that I get all the money into PayPal. I get a great report from it all. I transfer the money about once a week to my primary bank. But while my primary bank, I would still consider it my primary bank, the bank that's doing the most banking as far as receiving payments, and also I do almost all my payments via PayPal now,
yeah,
PayPal. So while I would still say that PNC, in my case, for my business bank, the company that's doing most of my banking is actually PayPal.
Yeah, very interesting. All right, so in other news, a UK hospital is now offering treatment for Bitcoin addicts, aimed at helping people who've developed a compulsion to trade the cryptocurrency. But, you know, I read news about, you know, in the US, there's day traders now that have given up trading stocks because they're making so much money on crypto. So, you know, you read both sides of it. I will admit to the fact that during the Christmas period last year, when, you know, we saw Bitcoin, you know, blowing up to 22,000 or whatever it was, that I would daily check my Bitcoin in my Coinbase account and sort of check out what was happening there. But anyway, so Castle Craig Hospital in Scotland is the one. They're running a rehabilitation course for people with drug, alcohol, and gambling addictions, and they have launched a similar program for cryptocurrency traders. According to many experts, the trading of digital currencies or assets such as Bitcoin can become a behavioral addiction, just like online gambling. Around 13 million people are trading Bitcoin on a daily basis around the world today, so that's pretty interesting. Do you guys think that, you know, I don't know whether you saw, but there was an interesting quote from Brad Garlinghouse, from the CEO of Ripple, this week at Code, the conference in California, where he said that he thinks that Bitcoin is going to become the Napster of digital currencies, that it'll be the formation for what comes next, but it's not going to be the dominant digital currency. What do you guys think about that?
Well, that's certainly a common pattern. Right, the groundbreaker usually doesn't become the industry standard or a new standard.
Yeah, Ron, what are your thoughts about it in a U.S. perspective?
I would tend to agree with him. I think something else will emerge that will become the standard adoption, but it will be something under the regulatory banner, not something unregulated in the, you know, Wild West kind of a thing.
Mm. Yeah. All right. Jim, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think what we're going to find is segmentation of the usage. I think we'll find certain cryptocurrencies working for some solutions while there's other. But I would follow along with the other two in saying that Bitcoin is an all things to all people type scenario. And I think we're going to find that, as with a lot of the financial products, we're going to see some segmentation done.
Yeah, exactly. All right, JP.
Well, we've talked a lot on the show about unbundling and rebundling and how the unbundlers would rebundle. Well, at least one of the rebundlers are unbundling now. Starling Bank, the digital challenger bank in the UK, has announced they're ending their partnership with TransferWise. CEO Ann Bowden told TechCrunch that they think they can provide a better experience by doing it themselves. Well, this comes as they're ramping up hiring to expand into business banking, and reportedly they're working on an £80 million funding round, which would be their first outside money.
Did you guys see the little case study that Ann Bowden's team did regarding using credit cards or debit cards overseas? It was super interesting. They sent two twins overseas from the UK with Starling debit cards, and one of them paid only in UK pounds and the other paid in the local currency. You know how you get that option at the point of sale in Europe, where they'll bring the point of sale terminal to you and you have to choose, do you want to pay in your home currency or the local currency? Right. And the twin that paid in UK sterling, so ended up spending about 10% more than her twin, because the exchange rate is up to the individual merchant at the point of sale, which I didn't know.
Yeah.
You think about that, Brett, on a hotel alone, that would kill you.
Yeah. That's one that it's a trap I fall into, and I'm like, holy cow, I never realized it was like that. So it's going to completely change my behavior. Obviously, I do a lot of OS stuff, but I thought it was super interesting. Props to Anne for that research.
Well, this is one I can stand vindicated as having done it right all along. I always just assumed, you know, my bank's Forex translation was going to be a lot better than, you know, some merchant I'm standing at.
And, well, I assumed it was a MasterCard or Visa-powered thing, but it's not. The merchant can actually configure, it has some control over the exchange rate. So, bit of a shock to me, but really, really interesting data. So, for those of you that travel. But, have you guys checked out Mary Meeker's Internet Trends Report? Every year, it comes out, and massive in terms of coverage in the media. Always super insightful. I thought the data that China in particular, what's happening in China, just incredible data coming out of this report. But Jim, what stood out to you in the report specifically?
Well, a couple things. The internet usage and all that was pretty logical, but I think what was interesting was the whole impact of e-commerce and Amazon and Google. So it was found that over 70%, around 78% of product searches now are done either through Amazon, which had the majority, or Google. So you're starting to see that, you know, we have to realize that people are searching for things differently than they have in the past. And then it dovetails into the whole conversation around voice. And voice continues to get a lot of play. And I think what's unique about the whole voice discussion is that for the first time, the consumer's uptake on the devices and on the technology is outpacing our ability to fulfill their needs for what they want to use it for. So unlike, you know, mobile banking and mobile payments and all that, the consumer's been late to the game as far as take-up, they're actually leading the charge on voice. So I think, you know, when you look at e-commerce and I think the report said that better than 15% year-to-year growth on e-commerce versus retail store sales. I mean, these all kind of make sense, but I think the extent of it is extraordinary.
Yeah, all right. So, Ron, what are your thoughts on it? I mean, I think obviously the big internet reaching half of the world's population now, as a stat, is a pretty big stat. But obviously with mobile, that's going to, you know, climb pretty rapidly. But what else, you know, sort of stood out to you?
Well, please keep in mind that I'm only through the first 6,300 pages of the report. So I still have a bit more to kind of comb through. So please keep that in mind. But there were a couple things in those first 6,300 pages that did catch my eye. The first is that over the past 3 years, Facebook has doubled its annualized revenue per daily user. And that's a pretty strong statistic. And in fact, you know, I look at that and wish that a lot of the banks I deal with, rather than sitting around bragging about how many mobile users they have, would be measuring their
ROE,
their revenue.
0.2%.
Yeah. So the second thing was the...
I mean, it was an amazing amount of purchases off of Facebook that they also found. I mean, people are buying products from Facebook.
Yeah. So that revenue really points, you know, for all the grief that Facebook takes. And, you know, there is another stat in the report on the American consumers, on the American Customer Satisfaction Index, where Facebook's, you know, user satisfaction is significantly lower than the overall average for the U.S. So that's a bad sign for them, but it's certainly not hurting their revenue. The other thing that caught my eye was the R&D and CapEx numbers. You know, there was a segment a couple of weeks ago on Breaking Banks where I forget if there was a guest or if it was a co-host who was talking about how, you know, short-termism and how that the focus on short-term results depresses R&D expenditures. And the numbers posted in Mary Meeker's report definitely do not bear that out at all. In fact, you know, the amount of money being spent on capital expenditures and R&D, especially among public companies, is really astounding. So the idea that the U.S. is not investing in R&D and innovation, totally false storyline.
Yeah, but where were the banks on that list?
Yeah.
Well, the banks weren't on the list, except that, you know, the R&D that they benefit from happens in a lot of the technology areas, as well as other areas. I mean, and that's always been the case, not just in banking, but, you know, you look at industry after industry that has benefited from R&D that has happened in the military in this country. And so, you know, looking at any particular industry line can be very misleading. But, you know, I think the storyline that was debunked for me was that, you know, public companies, because of short-termism, aren't investing in innovation and R&D. And the numbers in that report definitely don't prove that out at all.
Yeah, it was the biggest platforms doing the most R&D.
Yeah. And for the record, it's 294 pages long run. So...
Well, it feels like 6,300.
Yes, yeah. But definitely if take an hour out of your time and have a look at the data, it's going to be huge. Well, look, that's a good intro to us to, you know, talk about what's happening with banks and credit unions around the world. A couple of weeks ago, Chris Skinner wrote a pretty brutal blog post on small bank thinking. And Twitter just went off. So Jim was on, both weighed in on that, Ruth, Ron, and so I'd like to get your guys' perspective on this small bank thinking that Chris was talked about. We invited Chris on the show, but today his schedule, he said, was Warsaw, Copenhagen presentation, Copenhagen, Madrid hotel. So yeah.
No time for the show.
He couldn't fit it in while he was in the air between Copenhagen and Madrid, unfortunately. But that wasn't going to work. But he'll be on with us back again in a few weeks to talk more about the U.S. launch of his book, Digital Human, which is happening. But just before we get to that, JP, do you want to just set up this conversation?
Yeah, Chris talked about being at a conference that was focused on smaller banks and how they can respond to digital change. And I know every one of us have been in that same role. And he talked about some of the excuses he heard. We have too much to do. It costs too much. But we have to build it. But the regulators won't allow it. But the big banks have the advantage, well, because they're big. And simply it's hard to change. And Chris's basic point was, I know it's hard, but you got to do it anyway. And so, Ron, maybe I'll ask you first, because you both had a lot of responses, but on Twitter, one of yours was, must be me, but I don't hear any of those excuses. I hear, well, we don't need to be digital. Our customers rely on branches, and people are our biggest asset. How prominent do you think that view is still today in the middle of 2018?
Yeah, you know, first of all, I think we need to clarify something that somebody alerted me to, is that the conference that Chris was at, if I'm not mistaken, was a credit union conference and not a bank conference. And that makes a big difference, because I think the credit unions, being a whole lot more retail focused than many of the community banks in this country, there are very different perspectives on what digital means. So when I said, I don't hear any of those things, I hear we don't need to be digital, our customers rely on branches and people are our biggest asset, I was thinking of the community banks, especially many of the ones that I deal with who are not very retail focused these days. They see retail as simply a means to gather deposit to fund their commercial lending. And because today commercial lending is still very much a relationship game, I think that's a lot of why they have the excuses for not getting into moving into to digital. On the credit union side, I have to say I don't hear those excuses. Generally, hear from the credit unions is great. You know, we know we have to change. We know we have to do it. We know it's hard. How do I get there from here? And that's, I think, the bigger problem facing a lot of the smaller and mid-sized credit unions.
One of the comments, Ron, that I saw you got in reply to your comment on Twitter was someone said that he'd been at an event and someone had said to him, I'm so glad I'm retiring and don't have to worry about this. I have to tell you, I've heard that frequently because I guess that's because I'm presenting at board level often, but it's not a strategy, retiring. It's a strategy for an individual, not for a brand, but
yeah,
but Brett, I have heard that.
Yeah, I have to say that was a great response, and I think that is very, very prevalent. There is an attitude. And you know what's funny is I can remember back earlier in my consulting career when, believe it or not, PCs were not widely accepted, was that was kind of the same attitude back then was, I don't need to deal with all this technology stuff. I'm going to be retiring in 3 to 5 years. It's going to be somebody else's problem. Right. I'm surprised that that guy actually heard that verbally from an executive, but I do think that that's a very prevalent attitude.
You know, it's interesting. I was at a meeting last week for a solution provider, and it was a board meeting, and it included both younger board members who have come from the industry, MasterCard and other places, as well as what I call legacy board members who are really your legacy community bankers. And it was interesting that the older bankers, while they're scared, they're also worried about, you know, somebody mentioned the electrical grid and the impact that could have on banking and things of this nature. They get caught up in the what ifs, and they're reliant on their suppliers. They're reliant on the providers to get to them to the promised land. And those providers are not really doing a great job in many cases, especially what I'll call the generalists as opposed to the specialists. What was interesting, and I think I talked to Ron about this, the younger board members, I was more concerned possibly because one of the questions that came up was around Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. And I'm thinking to myself going, I really hope this is not like where your thinking is when the bottom line is, are you providing digital account opening? Are you doing the onboarding? Are you doing the basics right as opposed to worrying about cryptocurrencies as a community bank? And, right. You know, you wonder if both of them are completely lacking focus. One may be worried about the boogeyman, and the other one worried about, hey, can I jump 5 steps ahead instead of 1 or 2, which they have to do.
Well, the you know, you got the stats on the digital onboarding thing. Less than 5% of U.S. banks can do full digital onboarding, you know, through either internet or mobile. It's like, yeah, it's a big differentiation.
Yeah, and Jim, to your point, you know, Jason Hendricks loves to tell the story of being in with a younger person from a bank we were working with, and he was talking all this big game about cloud, blah, 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 and the COO looked at him and kind of just fired, look, our effing phones don't work half the time, so let's fix that stuff first.
Well, you know, that is a big deal. I mean, because the basics aren't being done, and you know, I'll attend a major data conference, and you know, we'll go through 2 days of talking about all this great stuff they have. And I ask at the end, it's one of these humility moments for most of these guys is that and girls is that I ask, okay, how many of you today can identify when I walk into a branch that with my personal account that I also own a business account? And nobody raised their hands. I said, guys, you got to realize the customer does not see this as a differentiator. They do not think that you should not know that they're a mortgage customer, credit card customer, and small business customer if they have a problem with their personal account. But you can't show them that. You don't provide that. You know that internally. But the problem is none of your direct customer contact people have that under one umbrella. And I think, you know, I unfortunately sometimes use this in presentations that we've gone from a too big to fail scenario to too small to succeed because of the investments. I mean, for just, meeting government obligations and meeting the regulators, it costs about the same for a small bank as it does for a big bank. And so what happens is that fixed cost gets a whole lot smaller base.
Absolutely. Well, listen, hey, guys, let's just take a quick break. I know we want to introduce our next guest on the show and get into the comments on that as well. But before that, we need to have a quick break. Just before we do, today's show is brought to you by Provoke Management. The hosts of this and other Provoke.fm shows are some of the world's leading experts in fintech, futurism, innovation, tech, future of financial services. And if you want to have one of the hosts or one of our Provoke management team speak at your conference or organization, go to provokemanagement.com. But now it's time for a short break, and we'll be right back with more goodness from Breaking Banks.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the U.S. and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Medici, formerly Let's Talk Payments, provides solutions to the world's leading banks, insurance companies, and fintech startups to maximize the return on their innovation investments. Medici has partnered with FedFiz, the bank data specialist, to create a new solution called the FI Data Pack. The FI Data Pack provides proprietary ratings, financial metrics, and context for every bank and credit union in the U.S. to empower your sales and market team to focus on identifying the perfect financial institution for your next sale. Use code PROVOKE to receive a discount at gomedici.com/breakingbanks. So welcome back to Breaking Banks. This is JP Nichols, co-hosting with Brett. We've been discussing the myths and the realities of innovating inside some of the smaller banks and credit unions with Ron Shevelin and Jim Marus. And Julie Thurlow joins us now, too. She's president and CEO of Reading Cooperative Bank, about a $500 million bank in Reading, Massachusetts. Julie has twice been named American Banker magazine as one of the top 25 women to watch in banking. And the bank has been on the Commonwealth Institute's top 100 women-led businesses in Massachusetts for the last 4 years running. So, Julie, you're there in the trenches every day. What's it like for you to try to keep up with all of these changes going on?
Well, I could say exhausting, but it also is fascinating. I want to say 4 years ago, we went to Finovate for the first time. And just looking at all the new ideas and all the thought leadership that's happening in the industry and targeting our industry, it was just so much energy around creating and innovating. And I felt like a kid in a candy store. I wanted everything. And it's really hard, I think, to focus on what are the few things that you can do that are really going to move the dial.
Yeah, it is. We 2 weeks ago, we recapped the prior week's Finovate, and we did talk about that, going there without understanding what you really want to accomplish on behalf of your customers. It's kind of like going shopping at midnight when you're starved without a shopping list, right? So, you know, you said in an American Banker interview last year that your fintech aha moment came as you saw a Super Bowl ad for SoFi. And you applied and were approved before the second half started. What impact did that have on you?
It was really sobering, realizing that a company I'd never heard of, could afford the Super Bowl advertisement, and I could not. And they were speaking to my customers, and they were making it really, really easy to get a loan. And the interesting piece was the loan was at a 5.5% interest rate. So I know how good my credit score is. I'm a banker. I pay attention to those type of things. And it made me realize that the credit risk in our portfolio, if you fast forward this a few years into the future, all the lower credit score customers are going to remain in banking because and all the cream puffs, the really easy stuff to write, is going to end up going someplace else and getting it done faster and being more satisfied with the outcome.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. Hey, Julie, it's Brett here. You also talked about that balance of not getting too far ahead of your customers. So, you know, where have your customers made clear their readiness or demand for tech versus where do you think we might be getting ahead of them?
Well, I think it's recognizing that we have a whole host of different bands of customers. We still have those customers that won't use online banking. Then we have those that use online banking through their computer. And then we have the group that have adapted and adopted to using their mobile. And then, you know, the ones that will take pictures of their check and make a deposit and those that don't. And all of a sudden, we have a lot of different segments of customers that we have to approach in a different way. And I know, you know, the whole omnichannel conversation about being present where people want to do their banking. I think that's the piece that I'm trying to get my head around. And you know, when we look at, so we're a community bank. We're in Massachusetts. We're in 7 communities, and our customers behave even differently in each of those communities and behave differently with each retail location. Are we going to get the next customer in that location, or do we need to change?
Okay, so in the first half of the show when we were discussing this, one of the things that came up in sort of the Twitter conversation around Chris Skinner's article was the excuses or the reasons that bankers use to justify not innovating their brand, you know? So acknowledging that, yeah, it is hard, specifically, What do you find some of the real hurdles are to making progress in this arena? Or maybe what are some of the excuses you've sort of pushed back on as CEO from inside the organization?
So my aha moment for this year was that bankers don't innovate well at all. I observed the SoFi example and brought it into the bank, and we've had a lot of conversations around it. And so we've definitely agreed that we need to innovate. But then when we start to innovate or even think about it, we can find fault with everything, whether it's the compliance area of the bank or the credit area of the bank. If I have charged the lending division with identifying a solution that will allow us to write our easy loans themselves so we can spend our time and the bulk of our time on the hard loans And if you've been given permission, but then you go out and you look at 10 different or 12 different solutions, there's always going to be a flaw with the solution. And we have to give ourselves permission to have flaws with what our solution is, and then figure out how to correct that flaw. And I think that's, you know, where my realization is now. We need help getting outside of our box. We are, as bankers, risk managers. So we're going to find a problem with any solution that is out there. But being able to approach and partner with a provider and then get ourselves to an okay solution or a pretty darn good solution, but don't let good be the enemy here, and allow there to be flaws.
Mm. Yeah. Hey, Ron, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think Julie kind of nails it that when she talks about being risk managers, it's about the competency of the organization and the culture. And there is a very much of a risk management culture, and you can't get over that. But I think Julie kind of nails it with the point about finding fault with things. It's kind of natural to say, so the challenge, I think, of the problem isn't that the banks aren't trying to innovate, but that ideas get shot down pretty often. Just a quick anecdote. I was in a meeting recently, a bunch of folks within the bank, and somebody spurted an idea out, and somebody else said, yeah, we tried that already, and that doesn't work, to which the CEO said, yeah, but this time you won't be in charge of it. So that was pretty pretty funny, but pretty testy
Ouch.
Moment, but I think, yeah. But, you know, it just goes to show what the situation is out there and why new blood's needed and a different approach. You know, you can't change the culture easily, but I think it is the CEO's job to understand that that culture is there and to push on it where necessary.
I was doing an event out in Europe, a European payments conference. Now, this is admittedly 3 years ago, right? But I asked the conference attendees, who of them had an innovation department, right? And there was sort of some uncertainty, you know, from people putting their hands up. And I asked, well, why are some of you sort of hesitating? And they said, do you mean that we had one or we've got one currently? And I said, well, how many of you used to have one and don't anymore? And like half the room put up their hands. And I said, you know, why did you guys shut down the innovation team? And you know what the number one reason was? Didn't fit the culture of the bank.
I thought you were going to say lack of ROI because we tried them for six whole months.
But, you know, that sort of...
We had a very major bank, top five bank. We got told that their innovation lab has just turned into something for the investor community, not for the bank, that they have another place where they do their innovation.
Oh, well. What about, Julie, what about employees? How do you get employees excited about change? And, part of embracing that? Because instead of having this innovation department that, you know, it's all their responsibility. When you make it the entire organization's approach, you do tend to get more systemic change, right?
First of all, we've budgeted for innovation. That always helps when there's money that's been committed. From the top down, in all of our bank-wide meetings, we talk about the fact that we do need to change and we do need to move things. And we, in actually 2 weeks, our management team is going to be trained on how to innovate, to think differently, and individuals from outside of the banking industry are coming in to show us what it looks like. So I can tell you on the other side whether or not we learned anything from that, and whether or not we've been able to, whether or not we're able to change, you know, our approach to new ideas. But I'm pretty excited about bringing in somebody to talk about how we can innovate and how we can think differently.
So your bank is actually a cooperative, which means it's actually owned by your customers. So it's more similar in terms of its structure, I guess, to, you know, the credit unions, which are member-focused and so forth. You don't have outside shareholders. So do you think that frees you up, makes it easier to innovate, makes it easier to sort of put dollars into the future of the bank?
I would say yes, and then I would say no. So I'll give you, so the yes part is the board is supportive of the innovation and the change, and because we're a cooperative, we can make longer term bets and not expect the quarterly returns to happen immediately. And so we have a little bit more time that we can work on that and how we actually approach the market. I don't think the industry has that much time. And unfortunately, sometimes being a cooperative means you are not compelled to do anything. So mutuality can be something that's very empowering if you allow it to be, but it can also be, as you talked about at the earlier segment, the reason why you just look forward to your retirement.
So, Julie, do you think that bigger banks or smaller banks have the advantage? Because it seems like every time I talk to somebody, they always say it's the other group that has the advantage to be able to innovate.
So I actually believe that smaller banks have the opportunity as long as they give themselves permission. I think there is an opportunity that a smaller bank can be more nimble. If you're willing to commit the resources and partner with the right organization, I can imagine that a community bank could be a really great resource to a fintech developer and vice versa.
Yeah, and you know, I'll ask the guys too, Jim, you and Brad and Jason Hendricks, you were all with some executives of a very big global bank recently, and you talked about, you were surprised at how...
Who shall remain nameless.
Yeah, shall remain nameless, but the conversation was still weighted very much towards branch banking versus digital, and I thought the big players already had this all figured out, right? It's the Julies that needed to get with the work, with the program here.
Jim, you know, you make your comments, and then I'll jump in with that. What was your experience with those guys?
Well, you know, I came after you, and one of the three questions I got from the group, and they were a group of leadership people, so they're very, you know, expanding responsibilities and everything. And this person basically said, we should not ignore the branches. The branches are still an important channel. And I didn't disagree with her. But I said, we need to know their place and the way they're going to do it. Now, I think it's funny, though, that this week a sign went up in the corner of the center of the city I live in that says a Chase Bank is being built there. It's the place of an old gas station. The humor of it just is beyond me. But again, it's Chase is actually moving from 3 miles away to a quarter of a mile away. And I know our family, even though my wife's not as much digital as I am, she's never had trouble going to the Chase Bank that was 3 miles away. And she says, I don't know why they're building one closer. I'm okay the way it was.
Ron always talks about the hidden interpretation of the data, and you know, the fact that Chase has announced proudly that they're opening 450 new branches. The fine print of that press release said, there's no guarantee that Chase's total number of branches will not decline this year. And so I think actually what's happening is that, yeah, sure, they're opening 450 new branches, but they're doing that to consolidate. They're closing branches elsewhere, and they're saying, hey, we got this brand new digital branch that we're opening up. It happens to be smaller footprint than the two branches that they're closing to replace it with this one branch. But they're saying, hey, we're opening all these new branches. I think there's a lot of that. But you know, it was interesting. We won't talk about who the bank was, but there was a lot of talk about from the existing you know, the CEO of the fact that it's business as usual. He spoke a lot about branches, but you know, at the same time, you've got the challenger banks. Jim, you've talked about this as well. ROE for some of the challenger banks, you know, ranging between 9 to 17% right now. The best retail banks in the U.S. are sort of doing 4% ROE. So you have a core economics problem here. If your business is being delivered through branches, the economics are going to tail at some point. And so right-sizing of branches, I think, is pretty much inevitable based on the numbers. But anyway, I'm getting distracted. Julie, what's on your roster of innovations this year that you're working on? Like, what are some of the projects that are happening right now?
So So we're working with a company that is going to allow our customers to search for homes on our website so that they can look for a home and be in close proximity to a mortgage application there. We are opening a branch in a demographic that's very different for us. It is actually a largely Spanish-speaking community in Massachusetts. We're pretty excited about that. We're really focused on looking for ways to create credit opportunities for the underbanked, the unbanked and the underbanked, and also encouraging savings.
Hey, Julia, it's Ron. Quick question, because I know a lot of banks I talk to are pursuing or talking about partnerships. Are you guys looking at partnering as well with fintech providers?
We are. There's a few different companies that we're in conversations with right now. What I have recently observed, there's a bank here in Massachusetts that's partnering with a fintech, and they got in early. And I'm just really impressed with how much influence they were able to have on the product outcome by that early intervention.
I'd love to hear what the other guys think, but I've got to tell you that when I hear the term partnerships from banks and a lot of credit unions as well, I think they're misusing the word, because I really don't think they're talking about partnerships very much. There doesn't seem to be a lot of shared risk and shared revenue and responsibility. What you're looking, trying to do, or what you're seeing from that other bank, truly a partnership, or is it more of just investment or a vendor relationship?
In
this case, it truly is a true partnership, and that's why I found it so attractive. So both parties have something at risk, but they also are building value together, and I think that just is a home run.
I'll give you some response to that, Ron, in terms of Moovin's business. As you know, we've obviously got the direct banking model here in the U.S., but outside of the U.S., we act as a vendor. Typically, those relationships have been essentially, even though we're a fintech, we've been a new age vendor, if you like, innovative thinking, new tech that the existing players don't have, but they've treated us pretty much like a vendor. I will say, though, that is starting to change. We're now being asked to partner in joint ventures for creation of digital banks in multiple jurisdictions. So I can't talk about where those are, but essentially they're looking at the model of the challenger bank that we've created in the U.S. and they've said, well, why couldn't you just deploy that here? And what would be involved in us setting up a JV? So that's actually like a true partnership, even in organizational form. So,
yeah, I've got a quote that I use in a lot of my presentations from a fintech startup CEO who said the biggest barrier to bank fintech partnerships. Banks' procurement departments, he said, they treat us like small IBMs and hammer us with performance and risk clauses that would kill us if we let them.
Yeah, that's I've often made that same comment myself, Ron.
You just never gave me permission to quote you, so I do it anonymously. I quote you anonymously.
No.
Fintech leader.
One of the banks that we partnered with, early on in the process with Moovin, it took us, it literally took us about 6 weeks to do the tech, to get the proof of concept out, and it took us 8 months to get the contracts done. So, yeah. All right. So, hey, we've got a couple of minutes before we wrap up. So let me wrap this up with thanking everybody before we get to that. So, hey, Jim, what have you got planned for the next couple of weeks? You're on the road? I know you're in Austin.
I'm in Austin next week, and next thing I do is a fintech event in Charlotte. It would be, I think, the following week, which JP is very familiar with, but I'm going to be down there doing a keynote for HoneyFi.
Fantastic. And that's the next Moovinite, of course, Rami and Joe, Bex, both guys from... Yeah. Hey, Ron, what are you working on in terms of research that you're going to have coming out next couple of weeks?
Well, just published something on digital identity and what bank CEOs and credit union CEOs need to know about it, very focused from them. And the next thing will be a piece on cybersecurity, debunking some of the myths around cybersecurity.
Great. Well, Julie, thank you for joining us. Just for those of you unfamiliar, CEO of Reading Cooperative Bank out of Reading, Massachusetts. So, Julie, thanks for joining us on the show today as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And if you like the show, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating. Go to iTunes or wherever else it is that you download the show from, and make sure you give us a shout out. But, you know, we've got more than 200 shows. 5 years we've been at this. Plus, we've got episodes with FinTech 5, with Jason Hendricks, a serial entrepreneur, JP Nichols. We've got Breaking Banks Asia Pac with Simon Spencer. It's all available at provoke.fm. Check it out. But please do me a favor, share one of our episodes on social media with one of your friends this week, so more people get to learn about Breaking Banks. That's it for Breaking Banks this week. We will definitely see you again next week for more of the same. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.